Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on September 3rd, 2024. It's time to convene a regular meeting with the Snohomish County TV Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President, Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, Colin Willenbrock, our General Counsel, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, joining virtually is Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and in person today is Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or electronic devices at this time. This session is for the board and the general manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and the PUD staff. So our first agenda item is our CEO general manager briefing and study session. Good morning, John.
Good morning, commissioners. Hope we had a wonderful long weekend. First up is our media update and our famous Aaron Swaney. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, commissioners. Aaron Swaney, lead communications specialist. Any of the media report today?
Everybody had a good apparently famous
Labor Day weekend. Yeah, apparently.
Famous around here.
So we'll start off with the bill credits. So we got a little bit of coverage in the Herald earlier this month. We've had a smattering of other coverage in some other publications. You know, I don't want to steal John's thunder too much here, but we've given out $200 bill credits to more than 67,000 customers. There's been a ton of work that I'm sure you guys will be hearing about. Some of it was from our CSRs who fielded a lot of phone calls. And I asked them to take those testimonials down, send them up to me. So I've been kind of collecting those. And hopefully I can read one to you guys. I just wanted to read one just to give you a flavor of what some of these are. I just had another customer come in who received the $200 bill credit. And when I said her bill was paid and she had a $53.46 credit, she welled up with tears in her eyes. She said, I didn't know how I was going to get caught up. She even still paid her $100 she had with her today so she could have a little credit going into the colder months. Another happy customer. So we've collected a bunch of those. We're running some in the wire and we've run some internally, but they've gone to a lot of good people. And we've got another round coming out to get us to about that 70,000 customer threshold at the middle of September. Next up, we have the IRP. So we've done a little bit of promotion on this. We've had a couple meetings so far. We had one here. We had one at the microgrid. We have two coming up, and the Ever posted a little story on it. Just, you know, we'll also be putting out a press release later this week, probably promoting these two. I think September 11th, we have one in Linwood, and September 18th, we have one in Snohomish. And then we're also doing a power talks on September 12th. So just getting that all that news out about the IRP, letting people know that we are planning for the future.
No heartwarming customer.
No testimonial for that one. No.
Talking.
Sorry.
Yeah, but it's coming.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll get some from the upcoming ones. Just wanted to point this out. The battery project got a little shout out in the Bulletin magazine. So just wanted to kind of bring that to everybody's attention. And then this is a big one. So Kelly Stickney and our engagement team worked with internally, also worked with St. Vincent de Paul. Wanted to rebrand Project Pride. Project Pride kind of had been a little confusing to customers. They didn't understand the name and how it fit with, you know, what we were doing with grants for these customers. And so we worked with these groups and came up with Community Energy Fund. It kind of fits more in line. It's self-explanatory and got some good feedback from St. Vincent de Paul. One of the earlier options was Project Bright. We were kind of maybe going towards that option. And they came back and said, project's not a great word. It's a little triggering. So that moved us in this direction to Community Energy Fund, going through the process of rebranding that. You'll see that on the website soon. And we're doing that hopefully to debut at the October Run for Warm.
The St. Vincent de Paul that advised you on how to brand?
Well, they helped us. They run the program.
Interesting.
Yeah. So they run it. So they were
savvy.
Yeah. A very good partner on that. And then finally, the Evergreen State Fair wound up yesterday. We had a good turnout. I got a note from Laura this morning that we ran out of bags on the last day, so wow. That's great.
That's good. I gave out a lot.
You did give out a lot. I was there. Commissioner Logan was pressing them on people with the bags. but we actually displayed this big picture here. Some kids kind of playing with our microgrid exhibit display that we built. You guys will see that soon, as I think we're going to bring that to a commission meeting. And set it up for you guys and run you guys through that. So, but the kids got to play with it a little bit, brought it out twice. And they really enjoyed that. So looking forward to showing that off. And then finally, the because John is the distinguished president of the NWPPA board, our picture graces the cover of the directory. And this is a picture by Krista Rasmussen. So I want to give her a shout out. Cool. Just kind of shows our work. We kind of snuck our logo in there on the door. So I just wanted everybody to know that. And then finally, our birthday was this past weekend, 75 years old. And today we'll be pulling the last winner for the $75 bill credits. And then next month we're doing the grand prize, the $750 bill credits. So we'll be doing that as well. And we're hopefully getting them in here to do maybe a check cashing picture or something like that. So we'll see. That's it for me. All right.
Any questions for Aaron?
No, but Friday was a big day too. At the beginning of the new link at stations.
Yes.
From Snohomish County all the way to way down there.
I saw your picture in the Herald.
I've never been to Angle Lake, but
yeah.
For a senior ticket, $1.25 or something, to hop on at Linwood and go to the airport.
Yeah.
Saving the PUD a lot of money when I go to meetings.
Yeah. And our crews did a lot of work on that to make
I know. Happen. And
so very cool.
I know. It was a wonderful day. Got to ride on the I got off at Mount Lake Terrace, but I got to go.
a little John.
I just did one stop, but it was wonderful. I guess Sid was there too.
I didn't ride the train for this. Very cool. Huge turnout.
I'll be riding it in the morning to go to Portland.
I'll be riding.
I mean, not all the way to Portland. No. But to the airport. It'd be cool if it went. Well, I could change trains, but I don't think I'm going to. That would be Amtrak.
I still don't understand how the electrons know whether they're snow puddle electrons or failed state light electrons.
Oh, wow.
It's over my head. That's
the distance, but there's got to be something interesting there.
And I have a couple of questions from the man who's the photographer for my Edmonds News. And I'm not going to, I'm going to have to do some research or get your help. He also wanted to know about the he used to work for Seattle City Light. So yes. He was very interested in the voltage and also the interconnects. And how that's going to work. So I need to do some research to get back to him.
Yeah, I've worked with him before. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He's great. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. Next up, we have our cash reserves policy committee. Scott Jones is going to kick this off, and then I think Lauren Way will do the heavy lifting. But good morning, Scott.
That goes without saying. My oldest daughter just texted me about a car problem, so my brain got diverted there for a second. So we've been talking a little bit about reserve updates this year, and dating back to two winters ago, we talked a little bit about how we use the contingency reserve, the rate stabilization reserves, and then this past winter, we talked a little bit more about it. This has been on our radar since I've been here. We haven't really done a deep dive to what I'll say clean up, and that's a poor term to use, but just a refresh, I guess, on our reserve policies. And so we're overdue on that. So we decided to do that this year in conjunction with this, really thinking a little bit about our reserve situation and the rate stabilization reserves. I'll point out two or three things that you're going to hear today, and then Lauren's going to take it from there. I and Angela, who's our senior manager over our treasury group and supply chain, are here for support. But John is 100% correct that the heavy lifting was done by Lauren, who's our manager in our treasury group. So we're going to let Lauren walk through it. A couple of things to keep in mind. One is we talked back in the spring about closing back down the debt management fund. We had opened that fund several years ago and good reasons at the time, but we haven't really used it. And so we've decided to close it back down and pull that money back over into the revenue fund. That's one thing that Lauren will talk about. The other thing that we'll talk about is just trying to get our terminology cleaned up a little bit on unrestricted versus restricted. It's not the way we have historically talked about the reserves, but we want to start using that terminology a little bit more. And so we'll go into that a little bit today too. And most of the focus then will be on the unrestricted piece, because that's the piece that's moving a bit more and has, you know, more flexibility about it. And then the last thing we'll talk about is just a change in both the day's cash on hand target. And Lauren's going to run through a lot of peer information and rating agency information for you to see how we've landed at a number. And also a tweak in the calculation. Our calculation's a little bit inconsistent with the way the market calculates it. And so we're talking about changing the way we calculate it and then resetting the number of those days. So anyway, we're going to hit all that stuff. Angela and I will be here to assist on questions and things, and Lauren will kind of walk you through what we're doing. So let me hand it over to Lauren.
Good morning, Commissioner. Good morning, John. Situated here. So as you can see, Scott's name is on the slides here. He gave me the freedom to throw him under the bus. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. He told me about an hour ago that I'd be walking you through this presentation today. I am also about 6 months pregnant. So if you see him in the hall, feel free to call him a bully of pregnant ladies. All jokes aside, I've been working on this for, you know, the last 6 months or so. It's been a labor of love. It's been a really fun project to be a part of. So I'm really excited to be here today to talk to you about our results and our recommendations for you.
Before you get started, I actually was going to ask Scott a question. Maybe you could answer it. Why have we not used the debt management? You said we haven't been using it. So we're going to get rid of it?
Yeah, let me. Sorry, Martha.
So I'm a typical skeptic. Why have we not been managing our debt?
No, so let me back up. It's a good question. We kind of thought that you might be curious about it, especially if you weren't here for some of that early history. So the PUD had for many years what I would say is probably a more than we absolutely needed reserve situation. And so several years ago, there was a little bit of an intent to start pulling that back just very strategically. I mean, we're holding customer money, right? So we want to be careful about holding the right amount of customer money. It's not our money. And as a part of that, because we knew AMI was coming down the road and we had some other capital planning, we decided to carve out some money and park it in what we call the debt management fund. Now, I would say it's a use in lieu of debt fund, if you want to. I don't know about the term debt management fund, but we took, at the time, I think it was started at $90 million. We took $90 million and parked it over into another savings account, basically. When if you think about it in terms of AMI, right, we parked $90 million, and at the time we were thinking AMI would be around $90 million. When AMI project started really ramping up, the market for bond funding was very cheap. I mean, we did borrowings back at the beginning of the pandemic that were, I don't know, what was our lowest? We were down in the ones.
Far below one. It's about 50 basis points.
I mean, we were borrowing money at 50 basis points, 0.5%. We're not going to use $80 or $90 million in cash when we can borrow at 0.5%. And it's turned out to be a really, really good financial decision, because that money's still sitting out there locked in its rates. Then we've got, you know, cash sitting on the books right now that we've held on to that is making, you know, 4+%, 3.5% to 4.5%. So from a financial management standpoint, it turned out to be a good decision. But we're sort of past that now. We've got a good trajectory for how we're managing our capital program between cash funding, rate funding, and borrowing. Rates have stabilized. We still like the rate environment we're in. And so we just don't see a need to keep that savings account sort of separated over here. We'd like to just drop it back into our normal operating, what I'll call checking and savings accounts. We could move money between those if we needed to anyway. So it was a little bit of a, it's parked, but we can use it if we have to. So we think it's smarter to just pull it back in, simplify it, and then we can reset the calculations in days so that it's kind of all one bucket that we're looking at. I think we're past the major need for that because of the bond environment that we were in.
We have a follow-up.
Yeah.
How is that different from the sinking reserve fund?
So I'm going to let Lauren handle that because we're going to walk through in just a second the various reserves that we've got. And so Lauren can give you an idea. We've got lots of funds. Many of them are out of our control. A lot of them were dictated by bond resolutions and other things that we have to hold on to. So we've got a slide in here that's going to walk through what those are, and we can talk about what that is. Lauren.
Okay, thanks, Scott. Okay, getting into it. So today we're here to brief you all on our recommended changes to the electric generation and water system cash reserve policies. So a lot of these changes that we're going to be talking about today apply to all three. So you'll see some slides that isn't specific to any one system. And that's just because it's going to apply across the three resolutions there. And then today, no specific action, but we'll be back at the next meeting on the 17th to request approval of all three resolutions. So why we're here, so our current reserve policy was adopted back in 2018, and that policy indicated a review cycle of every 5 years. So it's time. We also have had some recent financial events that have, you know, triggered us to want to take a deeper dive into our reserve policies to determine, you know, if they're at the appropriate levels and how we might want to streamline and simplify. And then also, you know, noting here the our strategic priorities. So this really supports our strategic objective of preserving exceptional customer value specific to our reserve policies and our financial health. So our cash reserves serve, you know, a variety of purposes, and we're going to go through each one of our reserves here in just a moment. But highlighting a few here, they provide liquidity for our day-to-day needs, help support our capital infrastructure programs, help us to mitigate risks that could impact our financial health and our ability to deliver power and water to customers. They fund unanticipated projects or other contingencies, and then they help us to comply with laws, contractual obligations, and our bond covenants. So Scott chatted about this a little bit, but you know, we had some major goals going into this project. So we really wanted to, one of our goals is to simplify. So, you know, as we're going to go through here in a moment, we have several reserves, and within those reserves, even more funds. And so a lot of them, you know, we have to hold for various reasons, laws, bond covenants, other things, and really have sort of less control over the amounts that we're obligated to hold in those funds. And then we have several funds that, you know, we have more liberty over the amounts that we hold and what we use them for. And so one of our goals was to streamline how can we categorize those into an easy to understand way for the executive leadership team reporting and also reporting for you as the board. And then, you know, as Scott also mentioned, we did a lot of research around what industry standards are, what the rating agencies look for, and what our peers are doing. And so we really, one of the other goals was streamlining with industry standards and making sure that we're consistent there. Okay, so wanted to take an opportunity to give an overview of our reserves as they stand today. So this is the structure that was established in the 2018 reserve policy for the electric system specifically. A lot of these within these proposed resolutions aren't going to be changing. Really, there are a couple, but the bulk of them, you know, are restricted funds primarily, aren't going to have real significant changes to them. But again, wanted to take the opportunity to refresh what each of them are for and then the funds that live underneath. Quick error that I wanted to call out here, we can blame Scott for that, is under the project reserves there, we also have the Hat Island Fund, which is not listed, but it does live within the project reserves. So starting up at the top, we have our operating reserves. These are really there for our working funds. All disbursements and revenues flow through this fund, or through the reserve rather. And then our, you know, to the extent other reserves are responsible for some of those disbursements, we make transfers subsequent. But everything flows through the operating reserve, and it's there to support our liquidity needs, our capital infrastructure, investments, et cetera. So within, we have the revenue fund and the debt management fund. The revenue fund is the primary fund where all the revenues and disbursements are flowing through. And then the debt management fund, Scott talked at length about, and we are going to be proposing to consolidate that with the revenue fund through this resolution. So we'll be left with just one fund within the operating reserve. Contingency reserves. So these are there. We have funds set aside to mitigate our exposure to various risks. So wholesale volatility we've seen over the last few years. We have some funds set aside in the rate stabilization fund for that. Significant storms where we need to, you know, put out a bunch of cash to finance those storms and bring back up our distribution system. You know, oftentimes we're reimbursed for those through FEMA, but those don't come for several years, unfortunately. So, you know, having the cash available is essential. And then also we have the self-insurance reserve, which helps support our self-insurance program and our retentions that are required there.
Approximately how much money do you make that?
$10 million. Okay, and the benefits reserve. So as it sounds, those funds there, the post-employment benefit fund and the retiree health reimbursement arrangement fund, those are there to support our employee benefit programs. Okay, and then we have our project reserves. So these are to fund very specific projects. And they're typically required, directed by you, the commission, or required by state, or required by bond covenant. So we have our bond construction funds there. We just wrapped up sending down our 2021 bonds that we issued on qualified capital earlier this year. And we currently have the 2022 construction fund as well. And those are funds that we set aside through the bond issuance to finance very specific qualified capital projects. Okay. And as I noted, we have the Hat Island Fund. So that those are the revenues, the surcharges that we receive from customers living on Hat Island that are being used specifically toward the replacement of that cable. And then finally, we have the Customer Deposit Fund. So when customers sign on for service with the PUD, oftentimes they're required to make a deposit. We're required through state statute to set those funds aside in a specific fund for when those deposits are reimbursed to the customers. Okay, our sinking reserves. So Commissioner Wolf, you asked about these. These are required, specifically the bond principal and interest sinking funds are required through our bond documents. We set aside funds monthly to make our semi-annual interest payments and our annual principal payments on our bonds. We also have the Privilege Tax Fund, another sinking fund. We set aside dollars every month to make our annual privilege tax payment. It's usually around 13 to 14 million. And so setting funds aside monthly help us to not have a significant cash outflow on one month in the year because we have sort of set those aside. And then finally, we have the bond debt service reserves. So again, these are required through our bond covenants. These are sort of like a insurance policy for our bondholders. So to the extent that the district faces financial hardships or is unable to make a principal and interest payment on time, we have those reserve funds set aside for our bondholders.
I do have a question of clarification. I should know this, but other benefits reserves, post-employment benefit fund, is this the one that is linked to employees hired prior to a certain date?
That is the retiree health reimbursement arrangement fund prior to 2009.
Okay.
Specifically.
I don't need to spend any more time on this.
Okay. So the generation system here, similar reserve structure, but you'll notice has a couple fewer reserves. So we don't hold benefit reserves in this fund or within the generation system rather. And we also don't have contingency reserves, but all of the others similar. And reserve structure. Also wanting to point out another error here, apologies. The debt management fund does not live in the generation system. We only have a debt management fund within the electric system. So under the operating reserve for the generation system, we only have revenue funds. We have one revenue fund for each one of our profit centers or projects. So Hancock, Halligan, Biofuel, all of the projects within generation have their own revenue fund. Under project reserves, we have specifically, we talked already about construction funds. We don't have any construction funds under the generation system right now, but I did want to have that there as a placeholder in the event we issue generation system bonds that would apply here. And then we also have the two Jackson funds listed there that are a byproduct of our FERC licensing agreement. All right, the water system, so similar structure here as well. I'm going to skip past the operating contingency because we've chatted about those. Under the project reserves, just highlighting these three unique funds to the water system, the General Facility Charge Fund, Lake Rossiger Septic, and the Warm Beach Fund. So the GFC, or the General Facility Charge Fund, those are surcharges that we receive and set aside to be used towards specific capital projects of the water system. The Lake Rossiger Septic Fund, those are surcharges from Lake Rossiger customers for septic pumping out in that area. And then the Warm Beach Fund, those are surcharges that we receive for Warm Beach customers that are to be used specifically toward Warm Beach improvements after the acquisition here a couple of years ago. Any questions on water before I move on? All righty, so going into specific updates in these resolutions that we're proposing. So as Scott mentioned, we're recommending to close the debt management fund and transfer the remaining $80 million balance into the revenue fund. Really streamlining there, simplifying, having one bucket of funds that we going to be operating out of. And then probably, you know, one of the most significant changes here that we're recommending is to create two categories for high-level reporting. So creating an unrestricted and a restricted category to funnel or to report each one of these funds into. So, you know, this really is the goal of simplification. This helps support that goal. You know, we have several funds, as I noted, a lot of funds that we're required to have through law or covenant, and that we really can't use other than for very, very specific purposes. And those fall into the restricted category. So those have a legally enforceable requirement through our bond resolutions, law, contractual agreement, or as committed by the commission to be used very specifically. And so we also wanted to create an unrestricted category or a category of funds where, you know, we can use these for really any purpose, either, you know, through our finance operations or by redirection by the board. And you'll see underneath each one of these, I've listed the funds that are relevant to each category. So you'll see there's sort of a blend of reserves and funds there. The classification is going to be done at the fund level, but to the extent each fund within a reserve is unrestricted or restricted, we've included just the reserve there. So for example, the operating reserve, there's only one fund or will be only one fund. And so we've included just the operating reserve there. Similarly, the benefits reserves, those are both restricted funds as they've been created through commission resolution for a very specific purpose. And there is a claim to those funds. We've included the benefits reserves rather than listing each fund underneath.
So let me ask you a question on the self-insurance fund. So is it a fund, if it's restricted, is it for specific insurance risk? Is it for like LI risk, or is it for any other risks that are normal insurance coverage?
Yeah, I might phone a friend here, Angela, if she wants to speak a little bit more to the insurance, our insurance program. But the self-insurance fund really does support our retentions that are required to maintain our insurance levels as they stand today. So, you know, to keep our premiums where they are, we're have our deductible set at a certain level, and our self-insurance fund supports those deductibles.
For all our insurance.
Okay, thanks. Any additional questions or thoughts here on the categorization?
All systems, first of all, the unrestricted category. Can you give me, it says maybe used or redirected for use by, can you give me some examples?
Yeah, so
will help me understand with that.
Sure. So our operating reserve is, you know, we'll have our just our revenue fund within it. And those can be used to meet any operating obligation. So, you know, we use that fund specifically for to bring in all of our revenues and fund all of our disbursements to the extent they are not defined within another reserve. Our privilege tax fund, we do set aside funds every month to meet that obligation, but we are not contractually or required by law to do so. And so to the extent the board wanted to redirect those funds or use them temporarily for another purpose, we could do that. And then similarly, the rate stabilization fund. We have our rate stabilization fund and we use it to mitigate risk. But we are not obligated to use it for a very specific prescribed risk. The commission at your discretion really could choose to use those funds for any purpose that you see fit. Because of that, they are not technically restricted funds. They would fall under the unrestricted category.
So then... the board has delegated to the CEO the rate stabilization fund, as it's been folded up into this larger piece. So the board has delegated authority to use rate stabilization fund money for other things. I'm sorry.
No. This is a good clarity. Let me, one thing that we want to say here on restricted and unrestricted, a lot of times that word is thought to mean the manner in which you declare its usage. So who declares the usage? That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is restricted funds are used for a particular reason, and unrestricted are used for not a particular reason. That doesn't necessarily have anything to do with whether the board is involved in the authority to use it or not. So what we're trying to draw a distinction here is in the restricted category, those funds have a very specific use purpose. And then unrestricted does not have a use purpose. It can be used for any particular operating thing. That doesn't take away the fact that the board, as of right now and going forward, is the one that would declare the usage for rate stabilization fund. That rests with you now, and it would continue to rest with you. Right. But the main point Lauren's trying to get at is, even though you still declare whether that's used or not, it can be used on a wide variety of things. It's not legally defined as only being used for a particular thing. Does that make sense?
More sense to me.
Well, and something like Hat Island's a good example. We have funds for that thing. It can only be used for that thing. We can't move it out of there and use it for any random purpose, and neither can you.
So if you're bulking these into an unrestricted category, what did you call that? The contingency reserve is the broader category. So under that, operating privilege, rate stabilization are subsets of that. But the overriding control is with the contingency.
Well,
section of the brain.
Contingency is a good example of the difference between it's under a contingency umbrella, but within the contingency reserve, we have a rate stabilization fund that you can say could be used to support any part of the business. And then we have a self-insurance fund that is very specifically used for the insurance fund purpose. And so they're both contingency funds. We keep them under a broader contingency umbrella, but the restricted or unrestricted usage is about how we use it. You still are dictating whether we do or don't use those rate stabilization funds. But if you said, hey, we're low on operating fund, days cash on hand, we need to pull some money over and support the normal business, then you can tell us to do that. We can pull some money out of rate stabilization. We can help support the normal business. We can't do that with many of these other restricted funds because it's just not legally possible for us to do that.
So I'm confused a little bit because you've said that restricted isn't just about legality. It's about, it has a special purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm confused why the privilege tax fund isn't restricted. We don't have to have it, but it has a specific purpose. I'm still confused about the self-insurance fund, whether we're required to have it, our insurer is required to have it, or we just think $10 million is the right number to always have set aside for uncovered insurance claims.
Let me talk about the insurance fund, and then I'm going to hand it back to Lauren. You can have restrictions from a variety of different places. Let me just make a general comment. You can have restrictions that come from a bond resolution. We go out, we borrow money. Those are the easy ones to get heads around, right? The bond resolution requires us to do X, Y, Z. And so we do X, Y, Z. In other places, we may declare that we're going to have it. So we go into the insurance market and we say, because of the structure of our insurance program, we are going to do X, Y, Z. We're going to hold self-insurance funds for these particular deductibles and these particular insurance coverages. Once we make that declaration as a part of our insurance program, then we deem that as a reserved fund because now that money working with our carriers, working with the way we do business, has become to us a restricted fund. So in some cases, it's a declaration. In some cases, it's a more legal bond resolution requirement. But that restriction can happen in a couple different ways. Let me let Lauren talk about if she wants to add to that or the privileged tax fund too, which is another kind of interesting one.
And just to comment on your question, Commissioner Olson, just wanted to clarify that the use of these funds is really defined, or the restriction of these funds is really defined at the fund level and not necessarily at the reserve level. So they're categorized into these buckets for our ease of reporting and understanding what this, you know, the broader purpose of those funds within are, but the specific use of the funds underneath, the authority for use of those funds, and the other requirements are defined at that fund level. Regarding whether we're, you know, the requirement to hold those funds. So I know it says as committed by the commission under restricted, and then under unrestricted, we have redirected for use by the commission, and both of those are the direction of the commission. Something that I really focused on while going through this project was, is there a third party that has a legal claim to those funds? You know, if we used them for a purpose that other than what we said we were going to use them for, could somebody come in and make a claim against us that we used those incorrectly or that it should have been for their benefit, like the Hat Island Fund? To the extent we took those funds and used them for something else, Hat Island customers could come and claim that, you know, those really should have been used specifically for Hat Island customer purposes. And then our self-insurance fund, our insurance carriers, you know, potentially could have a claim on those funds because they have established our premiums based upon deductibles and the self-insured retentions that we've set.
I do too, because I still understand that. So, I mean, if we have our insurance covers half of the cost, say a claim, we're responsible for the other half. Why does our insurance company care whether we actually have the other half put in a particular fund? That's the part I'm not understanding. It seems like it ought to be part of the unrestricted. It's just one of the general risks that we're covering with unrestricted money. That's what I'm trying to understand. Or I understand it'd be a good practice to have 10 million set aside.
Right. I go back to kind of what Scott was saying my name's Angela Johnston, Senior Manager, Financing Risk Management Supply. I go back to a lot what Scott was saying in that we commit to those funds to obtain the premiums that we retain or that we get from the insurance carriers. So that's part of it. And then I'm trying to give a scenario that you would all be familiar with in that we have a deductible, you know, for car insurance. We have to pay our $500. We don't, you know, maybe as individuals, we don't have to share that with them, but the risk for the insurance carrier will be lower for us to not pay $500. But if we have a $2 million deductible per event, and that's going to be a higher risk of the carrier to ensure that we have that. So we've committed those $10 million for the maybe five individual events that we could potentially have during that year. And so they set those premiums based on that fact. And so we've specifically restricted it for that use.
So when we pay a claim, we actually pay it out of that account? That's just there for...
We have it there if we do not have the cash liquidity already in the operating fund. So it's there. If we do not have liquidity, we take it out of that fund and then we would replenish it over a period of time. So it's kind of mechanics.
Thank you. Okay. Commissioner Wolf had a question.
Okay, from time to time, we receive funds from the state, the feds, et cetera, for different projects, for different reasons, like easing the burden on low income or disadvantaged people, projects, or new solar, new this, new that. Where do those monies go? Do they go into project reserves, which are restricted for those purposes, or not for benefits, right?
A lot of times the funds that we're receiving, I think you mentioned the solar, are you referring specifically to grants or other?
Yes.
A lot of times we receive those on a reimbursement basis where the funds have already been dispersed out of our operating reserve. And so it, at that point, is a reimbursement to our operating reserve. Other times where we receive funds in advance, we're able to accomplish the reporting requirements through our general ledger. So through other reporting mechanisms, rather than creating a fund and transferring funds.
Not into any of the reserve funds.
Correct. Thank you. It really depends. Yeah.
It really depends. Okay. Yeah, that's always a good answer.
And then one other thing I might say on the self-insurance fund is that we do have reporting requirements, proving out that we have segregated those funds. I receive requests at times to, you know, show how much we have sitting in that specific fund, or, you know, explain how much we have set aside for those deductibles. And those other, you know, other funds that we've classified as unrestricted really don't have those reporting obligations or obligations to prove that we've set aside those funds.
So if we have the self-insurance funds in an unrestricted category, we wouldn't be in compliance with our some sort of promise to our insurers. Is that correct?
We would be reporting, if we classified them as unrestricted, we could still segregate them, and it's, you know, it would still live in its own fund, but we would be reporting it differently on our financial statements as a fund that's able to be used for an array of purposes as defined in that unrestricted.
They're by definition. Thank you. That helps a lot.
Commissioner Logan or Olson, I thought you asked a question about the privilege tax fund.
I didn't
ask. We did.
Okay, great.
Awesome. I think she had a chance to get to it.
We kind of looped around. Can you repeat your question on the privilege tax
fund? Well, my question to Scott was, why isn't the self-insurance fund in unrestricted, which you've answered, and why isn't the privilege tax fund, by that definition, for a specific purpose in restricted?
It is for a specific purpose, but we haven't committed to any other parties that we are going to be setting aside those funds on a routine basis.
Gotcha.
We have an obligation to pay our privilege taxes, of course, but we haven't necessarily told Washington State that we're going to be setting aside those funds in a very specific bucket that they can then claim to the extent we don't make our privilege tax payment.
What is a privilege? If I could.
They are taxes that we are obligated to pay for the privilege of providing electric and water services to our customers.
Okay,
I am not a tax expert.
Well, I'm not either. That's why.
Will Garber in our general accounting group is the tax guy. If you'd like some information about privilege taxes, I'd be happy.
So it's because we have the privilege of providing power and water.
I think it's like taxes we pay cities so that we can provide utility in their service area.
And schools.
I would like to proceed with your presentation to see, as we move through it, some other questions I might have. So I'm going to hold on. But I can get through the presentation.
Right. Here we just have a graphical representation of what we just talked about in the prior slide, and I do plan to include this in the resolutions as well. A little bit busy, but I want to pause here in case there are any questions. This sort of highlights where I was noting that to the extent all of the funds within that reserve are either restricted or unrestricted, we don't list them at the fund level. For example, the debt service reserve, we have several funds within, all of those are restricted. So we've just included the reserve there. But the unrestricted category for the contingency reserve has the rate stabilization fund, which we are proposing to classify as unrestricted. And it also has the self-insurance fund, which we've proposed that to classify as restricted.
So on the restricted side, is the self-insurance fund the only contingency reserve on that side of the?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
The reason I'm worrying about whether restricted, because when we get to the number of days we're going to agree to, we're agreeing to the number of days for the unrestricted.
Yes.
So that $10 million It's not covered by the number of days. If it's in the self-insurance fund.
Correct.
These are reserves we hold above and beyond whatever day threshold.
Correct. And I would just say that the days, which we're going to get to here in a second, represent budgeted operating expenses, whereas the self-insurance fund would really support those contingency payouts that would be above and beyond what we would budget in any one. All right, going into some of the research that we did to support our recommendation for our days cash on hand and the classification of our reserves as well. So did a lot of research around what rating agencies are looking for, what peer utilities are doing and what they hold. Now that doesn't necessarily dictate, of course, what we should do, but sort of helps support what the average is out in the market, specifically around days cash on hand or other policy levels. So what we say we're gonna hold in our reserves, specifically our unrestricted funds, and the actual levels of reserves that we hold are both important considerations for the rating agencies. So each time we talk with them, they ask us about our policy that we have in place around specifically our days cash on hand. Rating agencies rate, the district specifically, we're a AA rated utility. There are a variety of factors, qualitative and quantitative, that go into our rating. We're really looking specifically here at days cash on hand, which is just one of the factors that go into supporting our AA rating. Rating agencies look for, they tell us about their methodology. There's a big, long write-up about how they reach that AA rating and the targets that they're looking for from a policy and actual perspective. And they specifically for a AA rated utility, they're looking for between 200 to 220 days cash on hand for a public power entity. Over in the right, on the right there, you'll see a couple of graphs. The one on the top is a comparison of the district's days cash on hand compared to AA medians. So this is looking at all of AA public power rated utilities. So not necessarily the rating agency's target, but just what other AA rated utilities are doing or how much cash they're holding. Something that I wanted to highlight here is you'll see a discrepancy. There's two bars in that top right graph, a darker green and a lighter green there. One of them is our days cash on hand as communicated by Fitch, and the other is our days cash on hand as communicated by Moody's. You'll see a bit of a difference there. So each rating agency has a little bit of a different methodology, of course. But one of the key differences between these two rating agencies is that Moody's considers our rate stabilization fund an unrestricted fund when they're evaluating our days cash on hand. And so they include that in their calculation of days cash on hand, whereas Fitch historically has not, because we have included that fund as an unrestricted fund on our financial statements historically. A restricted fund on our financial statements. I apologize to have that confusion in there.
And that would probably propose to change that.
Correct. And so the hope is here that this will drive consistency between the rating agencies and how they view our reserves. And the final bullet here is that our current policy levels and our actual reserve levels lag AA medians and the peer comparison. By a bit. That graph there on the bottom right is our Fitch number. And so just by including the rate stabilization fund, that would bump the days cash on hand there. Pretty significantly. You can see in the graph above, the darker green is 136 and the lighter green is 197 days there. So if we were looking at Moody's data, that comparison would look a little bit better.
Examples.
Do we have Seattle's? I'm sure I do, but not right in front of me, but I'm happy to get that for you.
And I'm wondering, some of these utilities have very, very large hydroelectric projects. I wonder if that drives the amount of money they need to hold on to for the inherent risk of having so dependent on a very large project.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that really plays into the when rating agencies are looking at utilities, it's going to vary because we all have different risk profiles. We have different operation strategies. We have different projects that we own. And so, you know, again, the risk really does vary between each utility, which would then drive the amount of cash that you need to have on hand. So the 200 to 220 is sort of what they look for, but then they take into consideration all of the other risks that would necessitate a higher level or potentially justify a lower level as well.
Would they take into account that self-insurance fund? It seemed like they would.
They do not consider our self-insurance fund when they are calculating our days cash on hand. And I think that's really because we've set it aside for a very specific purpose. And again, the days cash on hand calculation is calculated on our budgeted operating expenses or our actual operating expenses in a given year. And that self-insurance fund is not there to support those operating expenses.
Seattle's
city. Can you just confirm, Commissioner Lopen, your request for Seattle's information? Is that something that the board all wants?
Well, I'm fine. Thank you.
We need to clarify that.
Yeah. Scott reminded me that Seattle is, of course, a part of the broader city.
Oh, yeah. It's a view. Okay.
Tacoma is too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a view. Yeah.
You're just going on. I imagine Seattle is pretty low.
At the utility level.
I'll have to take a look.
Okay.
I think Seattle may be, don't quote me on this, but I believe their rating may be outside of the AA category, and I was looking to pull in the rated utility, so that could be why I excluded it there. But again,
So Chrissy Granger is the CFO down in Seattle. She and I, among others, sit on a large public power council group. We talk about some of these issues. She does not look, they don't look at reserves exactly the same way as we do. And that was the reason why I was going to suggest that Lauren might clarify that, because our reserve posture, and I can't speak to Tacoma, but our reserve posture is very different than theirs, because they view their overall financial health under the umbrella of the city's financial health. And so we're looking at it as a standalone business, and they're not. Tacoma may or may not have that perspective. I don't have a relationship with the Tacoma person like I do with Kirsty down in Seattle, but I can tell you that in the discussions that we have on the large public power council about reserves, there's a lot of that conversation she doesn't participate in the same way we do, because they look at it in a very different kind of way. So not trying to push away the question, but I just know that dealing with them and trying to get some information from them about the reserves, the conversation's very different because they're dealing with a whole lot of other issues with the city.
Yeah, I guess I'm still thinking they sell bonds and and understanding what their level they're at. Because that's going to be my next question when we get through this, to understand what's the difference between us, our customers, if we're A-A,
AA. We'll get to that in a second when you're ready. I just have not had in my head, and Lauren brings up a good point too, because I don't think they're similarly rated either. But I've never really thought about or tried to compare us much on that particular issue, just because of the interplay on the financial health side between them and the city.
They are muni with some very unique.
Yeah, Muni Plus. Yeah. Muni Plus.
Yeah, I think it might be a good comparison. Okay.
Any thoughts or questions on this slide before we forward? Okay. Okay, so some proposed updates as a result of this research here. So we're recommending to increase our budgeted days cash on hand for the sum of all unrestricted funds to 180 days. So historically, we've looked only at the revenue fund for our historically 120-day requirement. We're now proposing to look at all of our unrestricted funds to support the 180-day proposed requirement, which again is consistent with how rating agencies view and report our days cash on hand. So the operating reserve, the rate stabilization fund, and the privileged tax fund together would support that 180-day requirement. And and then also noting that, you know, the difference between our current requirement, 120 days, and 100, and the future proposed requirement here of 180 days, you know, is 60 days. I would like to note here that we're also proposing an update to how we calculate this 180-day requirement so that it's consistent with industry standard and consistent with how the rating agencies calculate it. So historically, again, it's been calculated only on the revenue fund, and it has also excluded from the calculation our largest expense, purchased power. I have some theories about that, but you know, we've historically had, we do have, of course, the rate stabilization fund, which we know is to mitigate, is there to mitigate risks, and likely is there, you know, to help us weather some of the volatility that we see in the purchase power market. And so by updating the calculation to be consistent with industry standard, rolling in the purchase power requirement, and then I think makes a lot of sense for us to also include the rate stabilization fund, which is there to support against risk of budget to actual variances that may require additional cash flow.
Is the budget cycle a quarter?
Is it what? I'm sorry.
Okay, at the very bottom, a plan for replacement must be established to restore the balance to 180 days within two budget cycles.
Two years plus a little bit. It kind of depends on when we, so yeah, going down to look at the floor of 165 days. To the extent we fall below that floor, we would then have two full budget cycles after we identify that deficiency in the reserve to correct it, or the deficit rather, to correct it, two full budget cycles, so 2 full years. And as you'll see, we are also recommending a 3-year phase-in of this requirement. So proposing in the 2025 cycle, 160 days, 170 days, and then 180 days in that 2027 budget year. And you'll see that here next month when Sarah comes to you with our budget presentations. And then again, just reiterating that we have in the resolution recommended an established floor of 165 days. So, you know, we expect that through operational means, we will float a little bit above the 180 day requirement, where we could potentially fall below that 180 day requirement. But once we hit that 165 day requirement, we'll be coming to the board to notify you of that deficit there, and then proposing a recommended strategy to get us back up to the 180 day requirement. I also want to note, of course, we have the slide that we include in the budget report each month that communicates our current days cash on hand, and that will be expected to continue, so you can monitor where we're at with respect to this requirement
course, stay in communication to the extent that we're having any hardships or seeing the potential for us to reach this floor.
So I'm struggling a little bit with the range. I understand the floor. I understand having a floor of 165 days. But I don't understand what the 180 represents. We're not putting a number above the 180. As a bar, we travel between. So we can stay at 166 forever, but if we drop to 165, we're going to require ourselves a plan to go up to 180 in 2 years.
So the way that we have written the resolution is that the budget will be structured such that we will hit that 180-day target. And so we will be bringing budgets to the commission that have that 180-day target within.
So every year, we'll budget 180.
2027 and beyond. We're going to do it stair-stepping, yeah. But
if,
yes.
If we get below it for some reason in a year, then we're going to budget to get back to 180 in 2 years.
Yes, and that bullet there underneath, we're going to be budgeting to the 180 days, but to the extent we hit the 165 or below, we'll of course be evaluating all of the options and working with the board to develop that plan for replenishment to ensure that we're not putting undue hardship on our ratepayers, rate pressure, and that we're also leveraging the various tools that we have available to us to balance our budget, cost containment, debt issuances, reserves.
But replenishing could be rate increase.
3 year phase in could be rate increase too.
Yeah. Is that what that means?
Yeah, I think, to get us to a level that we have identified as the appropriate level based upon the research that we've done, we'll need to increase our reserve levels.
So holding in the rate stabilization fund doesn't help.
It certainly does. It certainly does. Let's see. Got it written down here. This is a bit, some accounting in the weeds here. But as of June of this year, under this new methodology, our operating reserve represents around 100 days. So without folding in the rate stabilization fund, we would be at a very significant deficit. The rate stabilization fund represents about 58 days. So it gets us close to about 160 days, which is a 20-day deficit below that 180-day requirement. So it certainly does help.
Yeah. I have more questions.
Move on here to water. So similar stuff on the water side, similar research here. You can see that water systems tend to hold even more days cash on hand than on the purchase power side. And we had a little bit of discussion about that this morning and why there might be such significant levels, and really, circling back to what we talked about on the last slide, that various entities face various risks. Certain water systems, certain electric utilities, et cetera, fall under the umbrella of a larger supporting entity. And so, while I think it's obviously important for us to take a look at the comparison to AA medians, we do need to also think about what qualitative considerations that we need to take into account when determining the appropriate level to establish for our water system. As I noted there, the water system has different financial reserve risks and likely a bit lower risk than we face on the electric system side from a financial perspective. So the water system isn't quite as exposed to storms. We've had historically volatile wholesale market purchases, and on the water side, they don't experience that
to the same extent. So rating agencies, there's a broader range there. It's between 150 to 250 days, whereas we only saw a 20-day range on the electric side. So they're looking for 150 to 250 days for a AA rated water system.
What are we rated now?
AA.
For both electric?
Yes.
Not AA minus.
We are AA minus for Fitch. AA for Moody's and AA2, or AA2 for Moody's and AA for S&P.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. And yeah, we got that. So again, conclusion here is that the snow put, or our water systems, current days cash on hand, lag the AA medians and peer comparisons. Similar slide here is on the electric side. You'll see we're including all restricted funds in to meet this 150-day proposed requirement. No privilege tax fund on the water side. So we have just the operating and rate stabilization fund here. So recommendation is to increase the days cash on hand requirement for all unrestricted funds to 150 days. And a quick update here, the water system is actually planning to phase this in over a 5-year period rather than the 3-year period noted on the slide. They have some large capital projects in the near term, which Christine will, I'm sure, talk all about in the budget presentation here coming up. But for that reason, I'm looking to phase this in over a little bit of a longer period of time. And again, updating the methodology here to align with industry standard, and then establishing a floor of 135 days with the same notification requirements and replenishment expectations.
Questions or comments?
Okay, so looking specifically at the rate stabilization fund here, a couple of recommended updates. So historically, we've had $115 million in our rate stabilization fund. The fund was fully funded in 2011, and we haven't used it since. We have had some internal calculations. We've had some discussions with the board about the appropriate level for the rate stabilization fund. We've built in to the resolution that we in finance are going to be required to develop a procedural calculation for the balance required within the rate stabilization fund. So we're now going to have a calculation methodology not described within the resolution, but in, you know, an internal procedure that we develop for the required balance in that rate stabilization fund. And the expectation will be that we will include that calculation in the budget and communicate what that level is on any given year. And so as a result, there could be some fluctuations in the rate stabilization fund depending on our budget in any year that will be communicated through the budgeting process. Of course, we want to call out here that a large chunk of the rate stabilization, a portion of the rate stabilization fund has been there and has supported our calculation specifically related to wholesale power market volatility. And so with the upcoming change to the load following product, our balance required in the rate stabilization fund may be influenced by that change.
So, if we switch from 120 days to 190 days, we even need a rate stabilization fund? I don't really understand the need for it if we have we're going to essentially make rules so we can only be down to 165 and we force ourselves to go back up. That's what I'm sorry,
I wish we never created this fund.
We cannot create it.
Yeah, we can. Let me make a comment that Lauren is probably not ready to say out loud. One day down the road, we'll probably come back and suggest that we get rid of that fund. I don't think we want to do that today. And as a part of all of this cleanup, what I would like to do is give ourselves a year or two of experience with load following so that we can have some good history to see what kind of cost volatility we're looking at in that new environment. And then I would say my teaser here is that 24 months down the road, we may come back and say in our ongoing efforts for simplification, let's get rid of that fund too. And yeah, that way we
I
can
understand that yeah. now based on what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And I,
over that time, maybe we could just let that label ease on down the road.
Yeah. Right. but I think
fall off a cliff.
Right. I think Sid's point is really important, and it's something we've talked about a lot on our side is if we get in the mechanics of having the budget target and a floor, that discipline to me is better than having this other account sitting over on the side. So you know, we're already talking about pulling back on the debt management fund. We figured we would kind of hold there for a second, but I really do think that getting some experience with load following would be a good step. And then I think you have hit the nail on the head of where I think we'd want to go down the road. Yeah, please.
I might add something, Angela Johnson, in that it's this kind of holding period also in this calculation of what that rate stabilization fund should be is a good practice in understanding what our risk profile is and how that calculates into actual real dollars that we would see maybe fluctuate on an annual basis depending on our perception of the risks that we are faced with.
Now you know why Scott wanted you to do this presentation.
Yeah.
We were ready to be here.
My feet would get tired.
And we don't keep you.
Your feet. Get tired. Oh my goodness. Bring it, lady.
Yep.
All right. I wore my comfy shoes, so my heels tied. Okay, so again. Deposits to withdrawals from the fund may be natural through the budget process because of this defined calculation that we're going to be implementing. And any unbudgeted withdrawals through the course of the year would be required to be approved by the board and then would also be required to be replenished within two budget cycles.
But we're going to work parallel with what we just talked.
Correct. And because we've established, as Scott noted, because we've established this 180-day requirement, 165-day floor on all of these three funds combined, there really shouldn't be an operational need to draw from the rate stabilization fund, where historically we may have considered it because of the 120-day requirement on just our revenue fund. But now we're going to be including all funds. Of course, we want to leave it out there as an option to the extent we, feel that that is operationally prudent. But because we've established these levels on the combined funds.
Okay.
So. Any other questions or thoughts? What's the resolution time? Okay. Great. All right. A couple of other somewhat minor updates to the resolutions here. So our post-employment benefit fund. So this is a fund that serves to offset our post-employment liability. So this is the post-employment liability is an actuarial calculation of future expected benefits. Because we expect that we are always going to have employees. We don't expect this liability to go away. And so the fund there is really serving to offset that liability and provide protection to the extent the district ever needs funds to meet its benefit obligations.
Well, eventually that will go away.
Does
it apply to employees that work? Hired before 2009.
That's the retiree reimbursement.
That's not the bit. Okay.
So the post-employment liability fund, the post-employment benefit fund is currently funded at 100% of the liability. So we have fully offset that liability on our balance sheet. The way that the resolution that is written today, the 2018 reserve policies notes that we will adjust the post-employment benefit fund annually with those actuarial calculations. And because we don't expect to use this in the near term to serve cash flow needs, the fluctuation in that fund could introduce some volatility into our cash flow that we otherwise would prefer not to have. And so we're recommending that we introduce a range here of funding at 70 to 100% of the overall liability, which will give us that flexibility to either fund it additionally or hold some back to the extent we need liquidity to support our 180-day requirement.
Okay, post-employment benefit fund. This is benefits, not retirement. Right.
This is benefits post-employment.
Benefits.
Yes.
And so if you were to change that, the percent, doesn't that require opening the contract and changing it? Isn't that in the contract? Sure about that? Okay. I'm off this topic.
Okay, the self-insurance fund. So this is an administrative update that we've made just to align the resolution with the executive limitations that were recently updated. So increasing the CEO general manager's authorization for claim payment from $25,000 to $100,000. And then we have several funds that we updated the language for operational purposes. So we have several funds that I have listed here, for example, the Hat Island Surcharge Fund, Jackson Fish Habitat Fund, that in the 2018 resolution require John's authorization to withdraw from or deposit to those funds. Those funds have very specific purposes that are detailed in the resolution or detailed in contracts or law that we fund, we deposit to, or we withdraw from those funds. So for example, the Jackson license or the Fish Habitat Fund through our FERC license, we're obligated through the contract to deposit $200,000 annually. And then those funds are to be used for very specific fish enhancement projects. And so because those are so specifically prescribed, we have periodic adjustments to those funds, at times monthly adjustments to those funds in line with their intent. So we've added that language in there to just allow for that operational admin. Next steps. So we're working to finalize the resolutions, just do some final cleanup there with the support of legal. And then we'll be coming back on September 17th to request approval of the policies.
I think you get a triple A to us. You should get a triple A. Excellent. So much. Yeah.
Questions, Commissioner?
Okay.
No. So thank you. This is great. Great. I've been wanting to understand more about all this for a long time, and it's good to have an expert.
Absolutely. Thank you for all the good questions.
And John, the commission knows, I've really struggled over the years with what our day's cash on hand should be, and trying to make sure we have enough for risk. And I had written down, too, that it were changed to low quality, and we don't know what that's going to look like, presumably less of this. So what I'm struggling with is not realigning the funds. I'm completely supportive of realigning to restricted, unrestricted, and how we propose doing that. But I struggle with understanding the playoff between trying to maintain an AA rating and what it's going to cost our customers to maintain an AA rating, what the benefit to them of an AA rating is. So I don't really have that picture of how much money we borrow and the cost, if that's AA or if that's A only because we get rated. So my concern is to raise our balance. We have to do it. Our customers have to do it. We have to collect more. We have to collect more to get out the rate increase, the ratings. So that's my struggle. I'm completely supportive of the realignment. I can't at this time support the days that we're proposing. I need to see if we're going to do it in 3 years, what are 3 years of rate increases going to be? And what if we slip in our bond rating? What's that going to do to rates and the cost of capital? But I need to understand if it's going to increase the cost of capital appreciably. Like in 10 years, how would our rates look both ways over the course of 10 years?
So it's a good question. And I don't know that there's Treasury Department in the country that can give you a perfect answer. What you're getting at is our ongoing balancing act, which you're just basically articulating, the struggle that all of us have in trying to come up with exactly what pieces of this puzzle do we focus on in order to protect a credit rating. So let me talk about the credit rating stuff first. I can't tell you perfectly how much one upgrade or one downgrade might cost. I can tell you that the further you go down, the more costly it'll be, certainly. But the difference between where we are now and going up a notch is probably going to benefit us, you know, far less than a point, probably less than a half a point, and maybe even less than a quarter point. And so do I think that if Fitch says to us, hey, if you go from 180 days to 250 days, we'll give you an upgrade. That's not even close to worth it. And John and I have talked about this several times since we've both been here. So I certainly don't think we need to chase up, right? I think our credit rating is very, very good. And our credit rating is akin to the rest of our peers. It's getting us access to liquidity into the market. We're not suffering when we go out and try to borrow money. So I don't think we need to chase up. What my bigger concern would be is making sure we protect down, and in particular, protecting more than one down. And so what we're suggesting to you is for our peers and for the credit rating agencies and all the information that we're getting, that number needs to be probably 200 to 220 days. That's what they're telling us. We're not proposing to go to 200 or to 220, in part because I think we have a very, very good argument with the credit rating agencies on many other fronts. And I know. We have been reaffirmed our credit rating twice this year. Was both of those times this year, right? We've had our credit rating reaffirmed twice this year. And the day's cash on hand is something they would love for us to have higher for sure. But we've got a lot of other factors with governance, with operating stability, with our relationship with BPA, with the potential now to go to load following. So I think our proposal right now is to say, in a perfect world where dollars and rates and all of these things were easy to handle, we'd go to 210 or 220. We don't want to go that high because we don't think we need to. We would like to go up to 180 because we think that is on the very bottom end of a good, very stable range and phase that in over time, right? I do think that it's important to say out loud that we are probably 2 years away, 2.5 years away from having a better picture, especially with load following, of what that number should be. And Angela's point that she made just a second ago is a really, really important point too. I want to make sure we say again out loud, the process that we're talking about, the discipline we're talking about, we go through and evaluate what that rate stabilization reserve should look like. What she's really saying is that's the discipline we want to be able to use for all of this question that you're asking. And so we'll get in a better rhythm of understanding what the operational risks are so that we can come up with what we think that real target is. And it could be that 2 years down the road, we say, we don't think we need to phase all the way up to 180. Maybe we are okay at 160 or 170 because of all these other calculations and evaluations we do. But I am pretty passionate about trying to get up to at least that 180 on our plan, because I do think it's based on all the information that we're seeing out in the marketplace, it's on the very low end of where I think we need to be to protect our credit rating. And again, if we get a downgrade, I'm going to be awfully disappointed and angry about it, but I don't think it's going to cost us a ton of money. Two or three downgrades is going to cost us real money. And my last point is this. We're probably going into the market next year. I don't want to scare anybody to death here. We're probably going into the market next year for a pretty big sum of money between the capital program and some opportunities that we think we have for refinancing. So there's a good chance that we may have the largest bond financing that the district has ever had next year. Not all of that's new debt. Some of that's refinancing debt. We want to be able to go to the market with the best possible credit rating when we're talking about numbers that big. The difference between a quarter, a half, three quarters of a point when you're talking about $50 million is one thing. When you're talking about $400 million, you really start generating big differences in money. So it's a really good question. And I don't want to say that I've got a perfect answer, but I don't think we need to go to 200 or 220. I do like the idea of getting all the way up to that 180, which to me is the bottom end of the range that I'd really love us to get to.
So what is it about a day's cash on hand worth? So if we're at 158 now, we want to go to 180. How much money are we talking about?
One second, I have it written down. It's about between 40 and 50 million. Yep, about the amount of money. And I wanted to show one more thing just to echo.
I think you asked one day.
Oh, and how much is one day?
Well, that's fine. The difference is
the difference. Yeah, yeah. One day is about $2 million. Okay. So, around 40 million if we're deficit 20 days. And one thing that I wanted to kind of show here or drive home is that we were there with some of the financial pressure that we've faced over the last couple of years. It has drawn down our operating reserves a bit. We used to be above this 180-day requirement, and you can really see that in this top right graph there. Back in 2019, Moody's was calculating our days cash on hand at 223. And you can see over the last several years, we've been trending down. And right now, or as of June rather, our operating reserve under this new calculation represents 99 days. Under our old calculation, we are at a deficit as well. We're sitting at around 100 days under our old calculation. And so, to the extent that we're keeping the old policy as is, we would be having to make up that deficit through the budgeting process. Just wanted to kind of highlight it.
So 40, 50 million, that is about 8 to 10% rate increase over the course of that period. I think earlier this year, we said a 2% rate increase raised $10 million a year. Well, I guess it's cumulative. So one rate increase would get 30, 10, 20, 30. So, okay. Six, yeah. I'm trying to do the math in my head. Well, it's a cumulative effect. So, yeah. So it might not take an enormous amount of rate increase.
No, and you'll see those. Based on the assumption that this is the path that goes forward, you'll see the rate increases, the borrowings, the cost management, in the budget as it's laid out with that target of 180 days.
Right. My concern was approving this next meeting without understanding that effect.
What the rate impact would be?
Yeah, that's my concern.
Over and above what we know we're already facing?
No, it's all built in.
Okay, okay. Because we know that there's the reality of the fact that we're not out of the woods.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and that's a good point. Really, the driver for our deficit goes back to the conversation that we had this spring and then even until last year, and that we knew we were going to have some rate increases and cost management to get us to where we needed to be. This is just part of that overall strategy.
I think we've adjusted rather well, don't you, overall, to the increasing rates.
Yeah, considering the magnitude of the financial hit that we took from having to go into the market and the circumstances around.
Right.
It's $130 million impact that we've had over the last couple of years.
The good back of the envelope, yeah, like 1.5% of rate increase in the first year, which was 25 million over the course of 3 years.
On top of what we already had as planned.
In general, whether you do it or don't.
Let me make sure we say something out loud here, because we're, you know, our proposal is to finish 2025. You'll see a budget that calls for us to finish 2025 at 160, and then finish 2026 at 170, finish 2027 at 180. We don't think we're that far away in how we're going to finish this year. I mean, right now we think we're probably going to finish this year, you know, in the high 140s, maybe even into the low 150s. And so I know we're talking about what feels like a big jump from some of these lower numbers to some of these bigger numbers, but we've been tracking this new calculation for several months, and we've built our budget that you're going to see. We've built that budget based on the new calculation. And while it certainly puts upward pressure on rate increases and cost containment and everything else, it's not as drastic an upward pressure moment as some of the other things. I mean, our cost drivers and our capital program and some of those things are driving the rates more than this. And so I don't want to take away the fact that it absolutely is upward pressure on rates, but it is not by itself driving multiple digit increases on rates. We're looking at it much more holistically than that. And it's not driving it. It's one of many factors that's driving it a little bit.
Yeah, and I would also just add on, it was a point that Scott and Lauren had brought up. Prior to the last couple of years, we had been above, if you see, rate stabilization. Yeah. And I think, again, that's what the rating agencies have seen. The impact of our costs going into the market has really just put us in this deficit anyway that we're trying to climb out of. And again, it's all part of that strategy to now, if we throw a rate stabilization fund in there, put all that together, it's increasing our days cash on hand compared to what it was from a policy standpoint before, but it's really not increasing it significantly if with those consolidated.
I agree with that. Any other questions?
No, I very much user rather than passionate of agreement, or how do you say it?
Violent agreement.
Violent agreement with Scott on not letting our AA rating fall. I think that's really, really important.
The last thing that I kind of want to drive home is that you know, with the healthy level of reserves that we've had, it's really reduced the size or the magnitude of rate increases that we otherwise would have needed to make. And so by increasing these reserve levels and building up a reserve position, it allows us to provide stability for our customers and the rate increases that we do need to pass through.
Yeah, Anything else this morning, John?
Nope, that's it. Thank you, Lauren. Great job. And Scott.
It is now 10:39 a.m. and the board will recess into executive session to discuss the legal risk of the current practice or proposed action under the terms set forth in the Open Procedures Act. It is anticipated that the executive session will last approximately 30 minutes and will conclude at 9 minutes after 11. Oh, now it's 10:40, so 3 minutes. 11:10. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m.